many of you grew up in congregations where you observe these seasons of Advent and Epiphany and Lent, and some of you didn't, and that's okay. So if you didn't, Lent is just the season when we get ready for Easter. Easter is a big celebration, a big feast, and Lent is a season where we sort of try to make sure that we simplify things, that we get our ducks in a row, so that we're really ready to receive the good news of resurrection, celebration, and joy. So it's kind of this holy time of realignment, sort of like you can enter this season like a personal retreat. You can work on some stuff that you want to work on. You can look at your priorities. You can take stock, sort of where your primary energies are going. And if that doesn't feel right, if it doesn't feel healthy and life-giving, as Jane was talking about, you can make some changes during this season. Some of you received ashes on Wednesday, but whether you received ashes or not, ashes are the way you begin the season on Ash Wednesday. You head into Lent because ashes are the sign of humility and vulnerability. It's our way of saying we know we're not going to live forever. We know we only get so much time. And so now's the time to get things right, to put things in order, to become the person that God has called me to be. Now, we don't enter into Lenten season trying to impress other people. If you gave up something, great, cool, I hope that works for you this season. If you took on some new practice to try out during the season, that's great. I hope that's meaningful and enriching for your life. But we don't do it to impress God or impress anyone else. We just do it if it helps give us focus. If it helps us focus on something important, then great. But we don't need to perform for God. We don't need to earn anything because we already have everything. So that's why we entitled this Lenten sermon series simply, You Are Accepted. You Are Accepted. That was the title of a sermon by the Lutheran pastor and theologian Paul Tillich. Tillich was born in Germany in 1886. His dad was kind of stern. He was conservative, straight-laced Lutheran pastor. His mother was less straight-laced, a little more open and free-spirited. He was lonely as a child, moved around to several different boarding schools away from his parents. And because he was lonely, he read the Bible a lot. There's a good reason to read the Bible if you're lonely. He became a famous intellectual, a famous pastor and theologian, but he had his own trials, like everyone does. When he was 17, he lost his mother to cancer. Then he went to university and got a bunch of degrees. He served as a chaplain to the army during World War I and saw lots of things that changed his mind about how the world works, saw lots of things that he didn't want to see. His first marriage didn't work. His wife left him after just a few years. He did remarry. But he eventually got a teaching post in Germany and taught, was a very popular teacher, and taught until 1933. He had been very critical of Hitler and the Nazis, and so as soon as Hitler solidified power, fired everybody who had critical things to say about the Nazi regime, and Tillich was one of the people who got fired. So at that point, he was already well known in the United States, so Reinhold Niebuhr recruited him to teach at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and he stayed there for many, many years and taught there, later taught at Harvard and the University of Chicago. Some of the stuff he's written is incredibly dense and technical and academic and is extremely difficult to read, but he also is a great writer just for popular audiences. He wrote so that the general chap can understand what he's getting at. And so he had several collections of essays and sermons that he published, and they were bestsellers. And one of the more popular things that he's ever written is this sermon that he entitled, You Are Accepted. His sermon text for that sermon was Romans 5:20, which says, quote, where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. It's a wonderful passage. But his sermon text could have also easily been Romans 15:7, which says, accept one another just as Christ accepted you. So let me just read you a little bit of that sermon near the end, okay? So this is mid-20th century. I can't remember what year, but quote, Grace strikes us when we are in great pain and restlessness. It strikes us when we walk through the dark valley of a meaningless and empty life. It strikes us when we feel that our separation is deeper than usual. It strikes us when our disgust for our own being, our indifference, our weakness, our hostility, and our lack of direction and composure have become intolerable to us. It strikes us when, year after year, the longed-for perfection of life does not appear. When the old compulsions reign within us as they have for decades, when despair destroys all joy and courage. Sometimes, at that moment, a wave of light breaks into our darkness, and it is as though a voice were saying, "You are accepted. You are accepted. Accepted by that which is greater than you, and the name of which you do not know. Do not ask for the name now. Perhaps you'll find it later. Don't try to do anything now. Perhaps later you'll do much. Don't seek for anything. Don't perform anything. Don't intend anything. Simply accept the fact that you are accepted." If that happens to us, we experience grace. After such an experience, we may not be better than we were before. And we may not believe more than before, but everything is transformed. End quote. I want to make sure you see the line between Tillich's sermon and mine, although you probably wish I would just go ahead and preach that whole thing and forget my stuff. Fair enough. So he's done, the rest is me. So you are accepted, and there's nothing to do other than just accept the fact that you're accepted. Now that sounds good, doesn't it? To be utterly and completely accepted and loved by the God whose grace is so lofty that we can't even give it a name. And to rest in that acceptance, to receive it as the basic truth of your life. It's who you are. Yet sometimes it's hard for us to hear this good news, that God accepts us for who we are. We have this nagging feeling that surely there is an asterisk, a qualifying caveat, some fine print down at the bottom of a page. Surely God doesn't accept us just as we are. We all have our own little lists of reasons why God might not accept us. We keep little inventories of our own problems and our weaknesses. We know that there are a few things that are wrong with us, things that make it hard for the people close to us to love us. Why wouldn't those same things make it hard, maybe even impossible, for God to love us and to accept us? Through the rest of this season of Lent, our sermons are taking a look at some of the different reasons that we struggle with God's acceptance of us. Today's two readings are from Genesis and from Matthew 4 about the wilderness temptations of Jesus. These readings today invite us to think about our desires. Sometimes our own desires make it difficult for us to imagine that God accepts us and loves us as we are. So come, bring your imagination to Matthew 4. Notice that in the story of Jesus' wilderness testing, it is the Spirit who leads Jesus into the wilderness. Perhaps we should come to see the Spirit as the life force that leads us into honesty about our own desires, the life force that brings us to places in life where we struggle to refine what we really want and who we really want to be. The Spirit doesn't turn us away from our desires. The Spirit doesn't help us hide them. The Spirit leads us down to the center of who we are, to that question. It's a wonderful question, almost unanswerable. What is it that I want? It was Jane explored that about choices with our kids. What is it that I want? There might be lots of things that I want, but down underneath that, what is it that I really want more than anything else? If Lent does nothing else for you, just to kind of reflect on that question, we'll make it a meaningful Lent. The very beginning of Jesus' ministry is a difficult time of testing. This is good to hear for us as we enter the season of Lent, because we were hoping that our faith and our trust in God would somehow shield us or protect us from the difficult path. We had hoped that the Spirit would help us avoid the hard road and severe testing. We were hoping that we could just welcome God's kingdom into our lives and that we could also keep all of our illusions about success and happiness and pleasure and ease and comfort. But Jesus shows us that we have to give all this up as a kind of childish dream. We will have to deal with our desires during Lent. Yes, Jesus is God's beloved, the one in whom God delights. That's the voice from heaven that we hear at Jesus' baptism in the Jordan River. That's the passage that just precedes this in Matthew's gospel. But this good news that he's God's beloved, that's no ticket out of struggle and out of conflict. Only through suffering will it ever become clear what is our ultimate and life-defining allegiance. Only through testing will we ever be able to say what it is we want more than anything else. Only through these wilderness times will we ever break through to a new kind of clarity and commitment to our purpose as God's people, becoming the people that God's called us to be. The reading from Genesis is paired with Matthew 4 in the readings for today because both of those readings involve human beings coming face to face with possibilities that are evil in some way. Whether it's the crafty serpent of Genesis or the devil, it was our translation, the word just means deceiver, the deceiver tested Jesus. Whether it's the serpent or the deceiver, both stories suggest a crisis that lives at the heart of who we are and how we live. Will we live the life that God offers us? This is our question. Or will we settle for some lesser, sort of paler version of life? Neither Genesis nor Matthew's gospel dwell on the source of the temptation. I find this fascinating. We get no description whatsoever of the serpent in Genesis, no description of the tester, the tempter, the deceiver in Matthew's gospel. We are asked instead to give our best attention to these powerful stories about the purpose of human life. In Genesis, the purpose of human life is to till and keep the garden, to care for and protect the earth and our surroundings and our neighbors. What happens in that story is that the first couple, Adam and Eve, become distracted from their God-given purpose. Their desires, enticed by the serpent, send them into behavior that's at odds with the purpose that God's given them. And without too much difficulty, of course, we can imagine ourselves in this story. Given a sense of focus, this blessing of a purpose in life to be good to the earth, good to our surroundings, good to our neighbors, but our desires pull us off into other directions. Jesus, in Matthew's story, like our first parents, faces a crisis moment involving his own sense of purpose and his sense of mission. He too finds himself confronted by the tempter or the deceiver. No doubt his desires really were enticed by these possibilities for his life, but he refuses to go off course. He refuses to be distracted from the purposes that God has given him. In the first test, the deceiver invites Jesus to use his power for himself, to fix his own hunger by turning the stones into bread. So selfishness. In the second test, the deceiver appeals to Jesus' sense of vulnerability and his basic need for security, and Jesus is invited to protect himself, to make himself secure from harm and from death. In the third test, the deceiver invites Jesus to marshal all of his energy and all of his power and giftedness to enhance his status, his prestige, and his position above other people. Now, each of these three are real tests. So you can't read the Gospels and think, he's turbocharged, no big deal for him. No. If that's true, then they aren't tests. These options really appealed to Jesus. These are ways that he wanted to go. He would have loved to travel any of these paths. They're real temptations that speak to part of who he is. He has to struggle to resist them in the power of the Holy Spirit. They were invitations to a path that appealed to him, but in each of the tests, he deflects the temptation by finding strength in Moses' words from Deuteronomy. Moses, too, fasted on the mountaintop for 40 days and nights. Moses led the people through the wilderness for 40 long years. And Jesus, like Moses, he knows his purpose. He knows his calling. He too will lead God's people through the struggle so that they can find their own purposes and find life abundant. Now, when we read these stories of Jesus' temptation, our first thought may be to sort of imagine ourselves in Jesus' role. How would I do, and how am I doing in facing temptation? Now, that may not be wrong. I think that's an okay way to read these stories. We, of course, face temptation. We get pulled in all sorts of different directions and towards things that aren't healthy for us, aren't healthy for other people, aren't healthy for the earth and our surroundings and our neighborhood and our community. But we might want to do something else as well. We might want to place ourselves in the story in the role of the tempter. Maybe that's where we should stand. We have all of our own ideas for who we would love Jesus to be. As one commentary has it, quote, "Jesus refuses to be who we want him to be. He will not turn our stones to bread. He will not prove God to us. He will not turn from God to embrace the kinds of success we would recognize and applaud. He remains maddeningly himself." You and I are not the ones who remain maddeningly ourselves in the face of testing, but Jesus does. Jesus remains maddeningly himself, faithful to God all the way through, and he does this out of immense love for us. And he welcomes us to share in his faithful life as those beloved by God and accepted by God. We, on the other hand, are the people who have many desires, and some of them are wayward. Some of them are exit ramps from our own purpose and calling. Some of them are harmful to others and to ourselves. Some of us aren't even aware of our desires. We don't know what we want. We might be embarrassed by our desires. We may try to shove them down where we don't have to pay attention to them. We may not know that there's any connection at all between God's love and acceptance of us and our own desires, what we want. We may be dead to our own desires. We might be confused and worn out by the way our desires conflict with one another. But here's what I want to say as we end this morning on this first Sunday of Lent. You do not need to purify all your desires to get God to love you. God already loves and accepts you, period. What Lent offers us all is a time to test our desires. Not out of some kind of anxiety, just out of a simple recognition that following Jesus involves trusting God with all of who you are. This simple question, what do I want? What do I want? That can be a frightening question. We can only ask it if we're confident already that God accepts us as we are. God's acceptance provides for us the free and loving, gentle and welcoming space in which we can come with some honesty to the hard questions about what we want, about how we've organized our lives, about what we're after. And when you know that you are accepted, there is no reason to fear what you'll find, because whatever you find cannot separate us from the love of God. Whatever you find can never make us unacceptable. So we need not hide from it in embarrassment. We are freed by God's love and acceptance to laugh at ourselves, to accept it as part of who we are, and offer it back to God. Happy Lent.